This is the Greencast for March 11th, 2019. Peace delegation to Venezuela. Hey, everybody. Today on the show, I thought we would cover a few more items covering mostly media complicity in the drumbeat to war in Venezuela. Then there's a few pieces on the 2020 election and Hillary Clinton supporters continuing to rehash the 2016 election that I thought we would talk about. I've got a couple of pieces on the Green New Deal and the continuing climate catastrophe and everything else we're doing to destroy the environment. Border Patrol is still detaining refugees. I would call them refugees. Is still detaining undocumented immigrants without just cause. A couple of pieces on Ilhan Omar. A couple of pieces on the continued on Israel's continued human rights violations, and I thought we'd finish with a piece on Chelsea Manning's arrest. So I thought we'd start with a piece that I didn't get to include in last week's show. There was a piece posted on the Green Party National Green Party's website. I'd like to read from the opening paragraph there. Yesterday, February 27th, 2019, a press conference was held at the United Nations Press Room in New York to announce that leaders of the U.S. peace movement will be going to Venezuela to speak to government and civic groups about what is really happening in that country and how we can add our voices to stop any coup attempts or moves toward war. Four members of the 15 peace delegation spoke at the U.N. press conference, including Joe Lombardo, Ajamu Baraka, Bahaman Azad, and Sarah Flounders. There's a link on the Green Party page to that entire press conference. I encourage you to go listen to the whole thing. I think it's important. I'd like to play a short segment of Ajamu Baraka's opening remarks, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
Thank you, Bauman, and thank you all from the International Press Corps here this morning for this very important conversation. We're here to announce the fact that there will be a delegation of activists, human rights activists, civil rights activists, peace activists who are going to travel to Venezuela on March the 10th and will be in country for about 4 days. The objective of this delegation is to demonstrate to both the people of Venezuela, but also for the people in the U.S., that there are significant sectors of the U.S. population that are not in alignment with this illegal and immoral attempt to undermine the sovereignty and national self-determination of the Venezuela project and the Venezuela people. We have a number of people here who are representative of the delegation this morning who will offer some comments on why they are part of this delegation and the importance of this delegation. So first we'll bring to the podium, let me reintroduce myself. I am the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, a relatively new formation. We are coming up on our second anniversary on April the 4th. And we have been building ourselves as a new formation to recapture the traditional anti-war and pro-peace sentiments of the Black community. But we also see ourselves as an integral part of the broader anti-war, pro-peace, and anti-imperialist movement here in the United States of America. So we are very honored to be a part of this delegation to, again, demonstrate to the people of Venezuela and to remind the people of this country that there are significant sectors of the Black community that are very aware of the plan that the Trump administration with their Democrat supporters are involved in and reversing the Democratic advances and social progress that we have seen over the last two decades in Latin America.
And so that, I think, is the important point. We have to remember that this is a bipartisan operation, and Republicans and Democrats both want to, I'm not sure I want to say they want to reverse gains made by the Maduro government. I just don't think they care about gains made by the Maduro government in the face of a gigantic economic opportunity for the United States and for U.S.-based businesses. Remember, this is not about humanitarian aid. This is not about bettering the lives of the Venezuelan people. All of that is a lie. None of that is based in anything remotely resembling the truth. You have to remember that this drumbeat to war, like all of the U.S. empire's wars for oil, is going to be justified in any way they think they can that will get mass public support behind a war to steal the oil. And just as we saw in Iraq, they know that the public isn't going to support the idea that we're going to go in and make it more profitable for transnational oil companies to steal Venezuela's resources. So we have to promote this lie that this is about humanitarian aid or a concern for human rights. And it is none of those things. And do you wonder why? Well, let's talk about that for a minute. There was a piece that ran last week on RT, and I'd like to read a short segment of that for you now. Hang on just one sec. Let me get that open. This was a piece that was posted on March 6th on RT. Here quoting Elliot Abrams at a press conference, secondary sanctions, it's clearly a possibility. Here reading from the RT piece, Abrams said at a press conference warning that the decision to sanction third-party countries would depend on, quote, the conduct of the Venezuelan regime over time. The RT piece notes that 54 countries out of more than 200 around the world have bowed to U.S. pressure and recognized the self-proclaimed, quote, interim president Juan Guaido, who since January has been rallying support for regime change. The RT piece goes on to quote a political science professor at Bluefield State College, Colin Cavell, who says that the U.S. administration is, quote, internationalizing the Venezuelan conflict on a very dangerous basis, threatening other countries who deal with Venezuela, saying that if you do not support our sanctions, we are going to impose sanctions on you, Cavell explained. There will be a link to this article in the show notes. But you only have to look at the administration's own language here. If this was truly about getting humanitarian aid, if this was truly about getting necessary food and medicines to Venezuelans who were starving, we wouldn't be threatening to sanction countries who are giving them that aid. No, we want USAID trucks in the country because we're going to smuggle weapons into the country and get them to right-wing militias, right-wing rebels supportive of the right-wing government that Guaido is going to institute, and who has very openly said, very openly and very clearly said that he wants to throw open the doors to pretty much unregulated capitalism in the country. And we know what a disaster that's going to be for the Venezuelan people. Don't fall for the lie. And how do we know that this media narrative, this drumbeat to war, is a lie? Well, let's look at that claim that we've seen many, many times, several times in the media, that there's widespread global support for Juan Guaido and U.S. action in Venezuela. Abby Martin ran a piece on the Empire Files a couple of weeks ago, toward the end of February, that examined that particular claim in closer detail. There was a video that was posted to her Facebook page. I'm going to include a link to that in the show notes, and also a link to the full episode of The Empire Files. I encourage you to go take a listen. It's really, really good. Let's start with the piece where Abby Martin starts. Here's a short piece with various journalists claiming that there's broad international support for the coup in Venezuela.
Juan Guaido swore himself in and was backed by the rest of the free world.
And he has been recognized as such by the rational half of the world.
Now a long list of countries joining the U.S. supporting Guaido.
The sea of yellow you see there now recognizes the opposition leader, Juan Guaido.
This coup is painted as legitimate by the media and political establishment because of the international support from major U.S. allies in Europe and Latin America. But let's take a quick look around the world to see what that support really looks like. As usual, the African continent is erased from the dialogue. There, 51 countries recognize Maduro. Only one, Morocco, recognizes Guaido. Then there's Asia and Oceania, where again, only Australia recognizes Guaido. The other 33 nations recognize Maduro. Moving on to the Middle East, where staunch U.S. ally Israel is the only country to recognize Guaido. the rest in the region continue to support Maduro's presidency. Next, the Americas and the Caribbean. Despite 17 countries across the continent recognizing Guaido, 19 countries still support Maduro. While the majority of U.S.-allied Latin American powers back Guaido, in the Caribbean, the Bahamas is the only nation to do so. Lastly, there's Europe. Powers like France, Britain, and Germany have united behind the U.S. to support their puppet in Venezuela. Even so, stark opposition to this coup exists within Europe, including Italy, Greece, Norway, Switzerland, and the Vatican. So by international community, they really just mean a minority led by the white imperialist and colonizer nations, erasing non-white nations as members of the international community.
And so, of course, we're seeing the same lies used to justify this coming war as we saw with the war in Iraq. We're going to manufacture the pretext of broad international support when in reality, it's really only the U.S. and fellow colonizer nations, if I can use that phrase, which I think is entirely appropriate. Let's be honest here. It's really just a relative handful of white colonizer nations that have dominated the global south and have dominated Africa and the rest of the world, to be perfectly honest, for centuries. Professor Cavell makes that same point in the piece on RT, pointing out that three quarters of the world's nations are opposed to the U.S. coup and are opposed to U.S. military intervention to overthrow the democratically elected leadership of Venezuela. It's not broad-based international support. That is a manufactured narrative. That is a lie. And lest we think this really isn't the drumbeat to war, on March 3rd, the Empire Files Twitter account posted a short video. I think it's going to be in a piece that's going to be posted to the Empire Files YouTube account shortly. If you're not subscribed to the Empire Files, you should be. If you can, support them on Patreon. Details are on their YouTube channel. I'd like to play you a short audio clip from that video, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
The reality of a U.S. military attack and invasion of Venezuela is very real, and all under the pretext that the military must deliver the very same life-saving medicines they've been blocking from the country for years. The beat of war drums is deafening. We've now learned U.S. Special Forces have been sent to Puerto Rico, the usual staging ground for U.S. invasions. And the U.S. also threatened the Maduro government with invasion in secret negotiations. On February 18, Trump again threatened the government, telling Venezuelan soldiers to recognize Guaido now, or there would be, quote, no easy exit, no way out. There's no reason to take these as empty threats. John Bolton orchestrated the most catastrophic war of my lifetime. Elliot Abrams facilitated an actual genocide, and Trump is currently carpet bombing the Middle East. We know how far they're willing to go for big oil and the war machine. Potentially millions of lives are at stake. All people who believe in sovereignty and peace have a role to play here, to do everything in our power to stop this from happening, and to shut it down if it starts.
I'm linking in the show notes to an Associated Press article covering the last 3 or 4 days of power outages that have been occurring in Venezuela. And on the 8th, Abby Martin's Twitter account discussed power outages in Venezuela specifically. She's responding to somebody named Alex Rubenstein, and I'd like to go ahead and just read both tweets, and then we'll have a couple things to say about those. Alex tweets, "I like how Russia has claimed to have, quote, hacked our electrical grid, even though nobody ever provided evidence, ever, and the power didn't go out. But if you say that you suspect the U.S. is behind the power outage in Venezuela, as its coup there fizzles out, you're a conspiracy theorist." Abby's quote tweeting that and responding, you would have to be crazy to rule out the U.S. as behind any major event in Venezuela, considering it's in the middle of an active regime change-up and will stop at nothing to see it through. Abby also tweeted... Let me get that open. Abby also tweeted, Venezuela's blackout is being used as a new pretext for a coup. Shortly before the U.S. overthrew Allende in Chile, there were also major blackouts coupled with widespread CIA sabotage to, quote, make the economy scream. And so I'm including links for several of these in the show notes. I'm linking to a 1973 piece from the New York Times covering the Chilean blackout specifically and accusations from the left-wing paper in Chile calling that a CIA op, and we'll get to some foundations for some of that in just a second. Charges in the daily newspaper Ultima Hora appeared to be the beginning of a campaign accusing the United States of playing a role in the current political crisis. The newspaper called for congressional investigation and promised greater detail in forthcoming articles. The U.S. Embassy said nothing about the charges, and there were indications that Ambassador Davis would make no comment. The attacks, the Times is calling them attacks at the time, the attacks on Ambassador Davis are clearly a left-wing response to charges by the leading right-wing newspapers that Cuba is behind the crisis. Charging, quote, concrete and undeniable interference, Ultima Hora said that the United States Embassy had financed both the trucker strike of last October and their current walkout, which has shaken the government and virtually paralyzed the country. The newspaper accused Ambassador Davis of being an agent of the CIA. And of course, all of that sounds like the paranoid rantings of a conspiracy theorist or a government just trying to justify its opposition to U.S. meddling, or a government trying to justify its existing left-wing government against U.S. interference. Until you consider that we have, of course... We actually did meddle in Chile. We actually did attempt to overthrow Allende. I dug a little deeper. There's a good Wikipedia article that covers the basics of U.S. involvement in Chile at the time, and I'd like to read from a couple of paragraphs in that article. Of course, again, everything is linked in the show notes. Go take a look for yourself. Everything is sourced. Please don't take my word for it. Please follow up. Please look at the sources. Quoting from the Wikipedia article, Salvador Allende ran again in the 1970 presidential election, winning a narrow plurality. Then U.S. President Richard Nixon stated his fear that Chile could become, quote, another Cuba. And the U.S. cut off most of its foreign aid to Chile and supported Allende's opponents in Chile during his presidency. What does this sound like? Intending to encourage Allende's resignation, his overthrow, or his defeat in the impending election of 1976. To this end, the Nixon administration clandestinely funded independent and non-state media and labor unions. The U.S. feared Allende as president because they believed that Allende would seek to create a socialist state in Chile and that he would eliminate the United States' significance in Chile. On November 5, 1970, Henry Kissinger, warmonger, may he rest not in peace, Henry Kissinger advised President Nixon against peaceful coexistence with the Allende administration. What a surprise. And instead advocated one of two positions. The U.S. government had two approaches to fighting Marxism as represented by Allende. Track one was a State Department initiative designed to thwart Allende by subverting Chilean elected officials within the bounds of the Chilean constitution, and it excluded the CIA. Track one expanded to encompass a number of policies whose ultimate goal was to create the conditions that would encourage a coup. Are you beginning to see why the Maduro government is rightly afraid of U.S. meddling in Venezuela? We have done all of this before. We've done it not only in El Salvador with Elliot Abrams at the helm. We've done all of this for decades. This goes back 50, 60 years at this point. Track 2 was a CIA operation overseen by Henry Kissinger and the CIA's Director of Covert Operations, Thomas Karamessinis. Track 2 excluded the State Department and the Department of Defense. The goal of Track 2 was to find and support Chilean military officers that would support a coup. The agency, here meaning the CIA, would find military officers willing to support a coup and provide them with support. In September 1970, President Nixon found that an Allende government in Chile would not be acceptable and authorized $10 million to stop Allende from coming to power or to unseat him. As part of the Track 2 initiative, the CIA used false flag operatives to approach Chilean military officers to encourage them to carry out a coup. Again, what does this sound like? This is the entire Juan Guaido playbook happening now, playing out now in Venezuela. A first step to overthrowing Allende required removing General René Schneider, the army chief commander. Schneider was a constitutionalist and would oppose a coup d'etat. To exist in the planned kidnapping of Schneider, the CIA provided $50,000 in cash, 3 submachine guns, and a satchel of tear gas, all approved at headquarters. The submachine guns were delivered by diplomatic pouch. When Maduro says that he doesn't want USAID trucks into the country, this is why. This is why. This is... USAID comes with strings attached. USAID in the region always comes with strings attached. It always comes with the agenda of the United States government, the CIA, and plots to overthrow regimes that we have decided are not in our interest. A CIA and White House cover-up obscured American involvement despite congressional investigative efforts. The Church Committee, which investigated U.S. involvement in Chile during this period, determined that the weapons used in the debacle, here referring to the assassination of General Schneider, were, quote, in all probability, not those supplied by the CIA to the conspirators. Well, isn't that convenient? On September 10th, 2001, a suit was filed by the family of Schneider accusing former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger of arranging Schneider's 1970 murder because he would have opposed a military coup. CIA documents indicate that while the CIA had sought his kidnapping, his killing was never intended. Again, how convenient. Kissinger said he had declared the coup, quote, hopeless, and, quote, turned it off. However, the CIA claimed that no such stand-down order was ever received. After Schneider's death, the CIA recovered the submachine guns and the money it had provided. Both Valenzuela and Vio, these are conspirators who murdered General Schneider, were arrested and convicted of conspiracy after Schneider's assassination. One member of the coup plotters escaped arrest and requested assistance from the CIA and was paid $35,000. So the CIA did, quote, in fact, pay hush money to those directly responsible for the Schneider assassination and then covered it up. And then covered up that secret payment for 30 years. In 1970, the U.S. manufacturing company ITT Corporation owned 70% of Chitelco, the Chilean telephone company, and funded El Mercurio, a right-wing Chilean newspaper. The CIA used ITT as a conduit to financially aid opponents of Allende's government. So again, when you see journalists like Abby Martin on Twitter talking about the current Venezuelan blackout being used as a pretext for the coup, when she mentions what happened with Allende, this is not just ranting. This is not just conspiracy theory. These are things we have done. These are things we have openly admitted to. Sometimes it takes years before we're going to do it, but these are things we have all done. Every single bit of the U.S. playbook that's happening in Venezuela right now has happened before in Latin America. Just a few more pieces on Venezuela. JSC Counterpunch on Twitter points out, how bad does Guaido have to be to have his death squads stopped by Colombia, the paramilitary state? This ultimately links to a Bloomberg article. I'd like to quote a couple of pieces from that for you now. This is a Bloomberg article published on March 6th. Late last month, as U.S. officials joined Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido near a bridge in Colombia to send desperately needed aid to the masses and challenge the rule of Nicolas Maduro, some 200 exiled soldiers were checking their weapons and planning to clear the way for the convoy. Led by retired General Cliver Alcala, who has been living in Colombia, they were going to drive back the Venezuelan National Guardsmen blocking the aid on the other side. The plan was stopped by the Colombian government, which learned of it late and feared violent clashes at a highly public event it promised would be peaceful. Almost no provisions got in that day, and hopes that military commanders would abandon Maduro have so far been dashed. See, this is the real story of the coup. We're doing exactly what we did with Allende. We're trying to create the conditions where the Venezuelan military is supposedly going to turn on Maduro and they're going to force him from office for us. And if that doesn't happen, well, then we see what's happening. It's happening right now. It's happening all around us. Back to Bloomberg. Almost no provisions got in that day, and hopes that military commanders would abandon Maduro have so far been dashed. Even though Guaido is back in Caracas, recognized by 50 nations, which sounds like a ton until you realize that it's barely 25% of the world. Recognized by 50 nations as the legitimate leader of Venezuela, you don't get to be the legitimate leader by declaring yourself president. The impromptu taking up of arms shows that the push to remove Maduro, hailed by the U.S. as inevitable, is growing increasingly chaotic and risky. Quoting here an Evan Hill on Twitter, Bloomberg reports that Guaido had his own company of soldiers ready to shoot their way into Venezuela, but was blocked by Colombia. Hard to believe the Trump administration didn't know and was ready to spark an international military conflict. On March 8th, Common Dreams Twitter account tweeted out, quote, I think quoting this piece from Lee Camp, quote, the ruling class comes up with a lie to manufacture American consent for its all-American war crimes, and that lie is then sprayed like laminate all over average American citizens. And this links to Lee's piece over on Common Dreams. There will be a link in the show notes. Go read the whole thing. It's excellent. Lee writes, the invasion of Iraq just felt like it was a lie to me, and it turned out I was right, that it was a lie, and that the entirety of the American mainstream media and our government were either wrong or lying, and most of the time, both. The mainstream media and nearly the entirety of the U.S. government tell us Juan Guaido is the, quote, interim president, even though he was never elected to that position, and the current president is still leading the Venezuelan government and military. So I guess this, quote, interim is the time between Guaido being a nobody and the time when he goes back to being a nobody, but now gets to tell women at parties, you know, I used to be interim president. This is not the first time our government and our media have conspired to drag the American people into war with another country or helped create a coup that will inevitably have disastrous results. So I thought this would be a prime moment to go through the top four greatest hits. And he lists, of course, the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, and his number one pick, the bombing of Syria. There's a link in the show notes. Lee Camp's entire piece on Common Dreams is well worth a read. I urge you to go take a look at it. And just a couple of final pieces just to wrap up, hopefully, Venezuelan coverage for the last week. A couple of things on Twitter. Telesur tweeted out, thousands of Venezuelans took to the streets to march against interventionism in the country as part of the celebrations of National Bolivarian Anti-Imperialist Day. I believe that was tweeted out on March 9th. Yeah, that's March 9th. Of course, links to everything in the show notes. Please go take a look. Telesur has been doing an excellent job rebutting the mainstream corporate media's narrative that no one in Venezuela supports the Maduro government. That is, of course, a lie. Nothing is further from the truth. Steve Elner at Mint Press wrote an excellent piece. Mint Press's Twitter account tweeted out, Steve Elner draws the parallels between Trump and the Venezuelan opposition, led by self-declared President Juan Guaido. Link to the Mint Press piece is in the show notes. And finally, Benjamin Norton on Twitter wrote, the imperialist sadists leading U.S. policy on Venezuela are bragging about collectively punishing civilians with sanctions and economic warfare. Sociopath Rubio, Marco Rubio, boasted, quote, Venezuela is going to enter a period of suffering no nation in our hemisphere has confronted in modern history. And, of course, in Ben's tweet, he links to a Voice of America piece quoting Marco Rubio directly. This is the problem with American leadership. We have sociopaths who are openly, I've been saying on Twitter that Rubio has a boner for war in Venezuela. He wants a war. He wants a ground war. He wants to cause as much suffering as he possibly can. Rubio is a sociopath. We talked last week about Rubio tweeting out pictures of the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. He's tweeting literal still frames from a snuff film. Rubio is a sociopath. He needs to be sitting in jail right now. He needs to be tried for criminal incitement, felony incitement to murder. We all know that's not going to happen, but in a more fair and more just world, that is exactly what would be happening. Please, people, take a look at the people who are justifying this war to you and look at what they're doing. Realize that they are sociopaths. Realize that these people are fucking dangerous and that they can not be trusted with power. Okay, one other quick thing I wanted to go over. I forgot that I wanted to include a couple of excerpts from Steve Ellner's piece on Mint Press, so I'll go ahead and include that here. The link to the whole article is in the show notes, and the whole thing is really worth a read. It's really worth your time. Please go take a look at it. Steve opens with, "The anti-Maduro narrative coming from both the Venezuelan opposition and Washington paints the picture of a repressive, undemocratic South American government with an opposition that is simply calling for democracy. Naturally, our sympathies have to lie with the, quote, democratic opposition. But in Venezuela, the situation is more complex, and the overlap in the tactics and rhetoric of the Venezuelan opposition and the U.S. right is startling. Both the Venezuelan opposition and the U.S. right threaten the use of extra-legal means with possible violent outcomes. Fox News commentator Sean Hannity, for instance, reacted to demands for Trump's impeachment with calls for, quote, every honest patriot to take to the streets. Just in Venezuela, those who call for street mobilization in certain contexts know full well that there is a dynamic at play in which those protesting may well resort to violence. Venezuela is now on the verge of civil war because in addition to occasional excessive force on the part of security forces, opposition leaders have promoted protests that frequently result in widespread destruction of property and fatalities. 70-odd public transportation vehicles were seriously damaged, as were several metro stations and buildings during the 4-month-long protests in 2014, along with the killing of 6 National Guardsmen and 2 policemen. Attacks on an Air Force base in Caracas and police stations in the state of Táchira during 4 months of supposedly, quote, peaceful protests in 2017. Trump and the Republicans have something else in common with the Venezuelan opposition. They support neoliberal formulas in which the private sector governs the economy without any state interference. That means mass deregulation in the case of the U.S. and mass privatization in the case of Venezuela. This is an additional reason why the Democrats, who uphold different views on economic policy, should be reluctant to heap praise on the Venezuelan opposition, which is, for the most part, on the right side of the political spectrum." And, of course, here I would take issue with Ellner's claim that Democrats actually are particularly or meaningfully different from Republicans in terms of neoliberal economic policy. We have seen over the last at least 30 years that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's policy agendas are exactly the same. Both of the major parties exist to promote the neoliberal agenda. And that's exactly what this coming war in Venezuela is all about. Don't let anybody tell you that this is about anything other than a war for oil. No blood for oil, no blood for oil. We said it in the lead up to the Iraq war. We're saying it now, and we're saying it because it's true. This is a war. This coming war is a war that serves. This coming war is one that only serves the interests of huge transnational corporations, and it is in no way in the interests of the American people or the Venezuelan people. Okay, just a couple of quick pieces on the election. We're still hearing repeated claims that third-party candidates spoiled the vote for Hillary in 2016. If you spend any time on social media, of course, you've heard this narrative over and over and over again. If you follow me on social media on either Facebook or Twitter, you know that I've dissected the 2016 exit polling, which, of course, shows that between 7 and 10% of Obama voters in 2012 voted for Trump in 2016. I came across a New York Times piece which reiterates that. The title of the piece is, "A 2016 Review Turnout Wasn't the Driver of Clinton's Defeat." From the opening paragraph, "Instead, it's clear that large numbers of white, working-class voters shifted from the Democrats to Mr. Trump. Overall, almost 1 in 4 of President Obama's 2012 white working-class supporters defected from the Democrats in 2016. Either supporting Mr. Trump or voting for a third-party candidate." Now, of course, that's a little misleading because what they don't talk about are the numbers. Third-party candidacies averaged about 1 to 2% of the popular vote. Jill Stein's share of the popular vote was about a little over 1%. It's about 1.1% nationwide. And if you look at the exit polling in the three swing states, the share of the popular vote where Democrats shifted to Trump was, again, between 7 and 11%. So this is clearly the driver of the Democrats' defeat in 2016. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It has nothing to do with third-party candidates spoiling the vote for Hillary Clinton. Clinton ran a horrible campaign that bled voters on the left and the right because they were sure that they were going to cakewalk to victory. And we're seeing the same exact thing happening now. I follow somebody called Barbara Newsom on Twitter. She points out that she called this in last November, talking about the huge number of Democratic candidates who are currently seeking the nomination. She says, I called this in November. The DNC is going to load up the field with candidates so that no one will be able to secure the majority required in the first round. And then in come the superdelegates in the second round, and they pick the establishment candidate. We're going to see, yet again, another centrist Democrat that isn't going to appeal to moderate Republicans. Moderate Republicans will hold their noses and vote for Trump because he represents more of their agenda than Democrats are willing to admit. And progressives aren't going to flock to support yet another corporate shill with a neoliberal foreign policy and economic policy agenda. It's just not going to happen. The Democrats are going to do exactly what they did last time. They're going to bleed off votes on their right to Trump, and a tiny fraction of third-party votes that wouldn't have made any difference either way will once again get blamed for the Democrats' loss in 2020. I am predicting the Democrats are going to lose to Trump because we're seeing the same mistakes that they made in 2016 getting repeated all over again. What are one of those mistakes? Supporting a neoliberal centrist Democrat, this time in the person of Kamala Harris, with a hugely problematic record. When progressives say that they don't want to support Kamala Harris because of her record, this is what we're talking about. Counterpunch tweeted out a link over the weekend to an article that they posted in 2017. The tweet reads, that office was led by newly elected Senator Kamala Harris, talking about the California Attorney General, who was serving as California's Attorney General at the time. Criticisms of Steve Mnuchin as Trump's Treasury Secretary nominee provoked inquiries toward Harris as to why she refused to take any action, given evidence of violations that her office uncovered. And if you follow through to the article, I'd like to quote just a couple of excerpts from the article now. Harris was asked why she refused to take any action given the evidence of violations that her office uncovered. Quote, we went and we followed the facts and the evidence, and it's a decision my office made, Harris told The Hill in an interview. We pursued it just like any other case. We go and we take a case wherever the facts lead us. Harris' defense was politically published. I think he means politically polished here, but insufficient in explaining her actions as attorney general. Despite this seemingly unethical discrepancy in Harris's service as Attorney General, Democrats have focused on Mnuchin, this was during his confirmation, while ignoring the overt corruption from one of their own that severely undermined the Democrats' standing ground, that severely undermined the standing ground Democrats had to examine Mnuchin during his confirmation hearing. The Democratic Party has been run into the ground by its leadership to the point where they don't have enough votes. Coincidentally, before Harris passed on the opportunity to file action against One West Bank, which was evidence of fraud during Steve Mnuchin's time as CEO, before Harris passed on the opportunity to file action against One West Bank, one of its owners, prolific Democratic Party donor George Soros, was pouring money into California for California. One of its owners, prolific Democratic Party donor George Soros, was pouring money into California for criminal policy initiatives. In 2011, Harris's former aide Lenore Anderson was hired as a campaign manager for Californians for Safety and Justice, which was financed by Soros' Open Society Foundation. Beginning in 2012, George Soros led a four-year, $16 million campaign to change California criminal policy, which Kamala Harris was deeply involved with as California Attorney General. Harris's aide Lenore Anderson also headed another Soros-funded foundation called VoteSafe. In 2014, Soros and hedge fund billionaire John Paulson sold One West Bank for $3.4 billion. In 2015, Soros maxed out a donation to Harris' Senate bid. Kamala Harris also spoke at George Soros' 2020 Vision Conference in San Francisco with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi in 2015. What makes Harris's campaign donations and her decision not to go after One West Bank even more suspicious is that, despite Mnuchin primarily donating to Republicans, his only donation to a Democrat in 2016 happened to be to Kamala Harris. And this is, ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, the anointed frontrunner for the Democratic Party. Of course, we all know that in terms of popular support and in terms of actual donations, Bernie's campaign is on fire right now. But make no mistake, if the Democrats actually wanted to get rid of their kill switch in the form of the superdelegates, they would have done so already. I agree with Barbara Newsom on Twitter that the kill switch is alive and well. This is going to go to second round voting at the nominating convention, in which case the superdelegates will decide the nominee and the popular vote will be irrelevant. Expect the Democrats to nominate yet another neoliberal disaster, to borrow a phrase from Jill Stein's 2016 campaign. Another neoliberal disaster, and expect blame and recriminations to flow from all sides as Democrats refuse to acknowledge their own complicity in their defeat. A couple of pieces on the environment and on Senator Dianne Feinstein's rejection of a real Green New Deal. To start with, there's a John Upton on Twitter who quoted David Axelrod in a piece in the New York Times, who was a campaign strategist for Barack Obama. Upton writes, quote from Obama strategist Axelrod in the New York Times, quote, "Climate change, to our frustration, was never an issue that rung a bell with voters. But now we're a decade down the road, and the road is surrounded with floods and fires." Of course, blaming the voters for the Obama administration's inaction on climate change. That tweet is quoted by somebody called Toast Magnate. I love Twitter handles sometimes. He writes, "Of all the consequential actions our government can take without our consent, namely wars and expanding oil drilling, Axelrod blames inaction," here inaction on climate change, "blames inaction on the voters. What a prick. Our government has horrible leadership. This is why I'm voting third party. This is why I'm supporting third parties. This is why I urge you to do the same. We have just about a decade from 2020 to about 2030 to stop runaway climate change at this point, at which point there's really nothing that we're going to do that's going to meaningfully affect what we've done to the climate. I urge you, the time is now. We have to have candidates who are going to support a real Green New Deal that's going to mean a 100% end to fossil fuels. It's going to mean a 100% transition to clean, renewable energy. That's not fossil fuels. That's not nuclear power. That means wind, solar, and geothermal. We have to make these changes. Everyone claiming that it's unrealistic. You know what? Try growing food when the climate no longer supports or sustains human life. Try dealing with the massive, massive population changes that are coming as a result of climate change in their homes, disrupting their way of life, and the planet no longer supports them. We're either going to pay for it now or we're going to pay a hell of a lot more later. We have to get serious about climate change, and we have to do it today. A couple of more pieces on the environment. There's a Greenpeace campaign right now that's calling for public comment to stop drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. I'd like to read just a short bit from that. "Trump is giving oil companies a free rein to drill in Alaska's biggest protected area, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Yet the vast majority of Americans oppose it. The Arctic Refuge has sustained the Gwich'in people for thousands of years." I'm sorry, the Gwich'in. "The Gwich'in people call the coastal plain the sacred place where life begins. Protecting caribou is a matter of basic human rights for the Gwich'in, who are the indigenous people in the region. Polar bears, caribou herds, musk oxen, wolves, owls, and the tundra itself could be permanently damaged by 90,000-pound thumper trucks. The Arctic is ground zero for climate change. temperatures there are rising at twice the rate of the rest of the world. More oil drilling will compound devastating impacts already being felt from climate change throughout the Arctic. The public has until March 13th to submit a comment. I'm going to link to Greenpeace's form where you can please, I urge you to send comment to the Department of the Interior. We have until March 13th to submit comment. As Greenpeace notes, it's entirely optional. Add your own concerns to the prepared draft below. The Department of the Interior has to individually consider each non-identical comment. I urge you to please customize the form so that they will be required to actually read your submission, and they will hopefully consider it. There's a link on Twitter. Stratocumulus clouds could disappear in as little as a century, adding a total of 8 degrees. To global average temperatures. And we know that if we get to 3 degrees warmer, that's going to be it for a planet that, as far as we can tell, sustains human life. 3 degrees is our threshold for runaway greenhouse effects, and the disappearance of stratocumulus clouds in a little under a century, maybe a little over a century, could add as much as 8 degrees globally to global temperatures. Flint is still living with toxic water. I'm going to link to a picture that was posted on Facebook. We're doing absolutely nothing about water in Flint, which is still poisoned. We claim that we care so much about the humanitarian crisis, the invented humanitarian crisis that we invented, that we've gone out of our way to try and invent in Venezuela, and we're doing nothing about Flint. And one last thing I'd like to link to. The Green Party of New York posted a tweet on March 8th. Are fossil fuel investments and political contributions behind Senator Feinstein's opposition to the Green New Deal? They're linking to an In These Times piece. The piece opens with a reference to Senator Feinstein's, of course, predictably tone-deaf performance, in which she was caught on video condescending to a group of children who came to urge her to support the Green New Deal. Reading from their opening paragraph, on February 22nd, footage of Dianne Feinstein lecturing pleading children about her opposition to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey's Green New Deal resolution went viral. Several media commentators on both sides of the debate cast the video of the 85-year-old senator dressing down the children as a case of generational conflict. But the episode was also a reminder of the peril of wealth inequality in politics, with Feinstein, one of the very wealthiest members of Congress, having a personal financial stake in the industries whose bottom lines would be affected by the members of the Green New Deal resolution. Feinstein, whose net worth stands at $58.5 million, has been married for nearly 40 years to Richard C. Bloom, a wealthy investor who still runs the private equity firm he founded in 1975. According to Feinstein's most recent financial annual report filed in May 2018 and covering the 2017 calendar year, Bloom owns 100% of Yosemite Investments, LLC, through which he has hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in several fossil fuel companies, some of which he has sold off since the Green New Deal began gaining national attention. Pay no attention to mainstream politicians, establishment politicians talking to you about what's realistic or what's possible. These people are protecting their own fortunes. They don't work for you. They don't work for me. They don't work for the American people. They work for corporations, and they work to enrich themselves. Dianne Feinstein needs to retire today. She needs to be out of Congress. Again, like getting Marco Rubio to stand trial for inciting violence and murder, that's not going to happen. But the truth of what's going on is plainly obvious if only you have eyes to see and ears to hear. Okay, there were a couple of things I didn't quite get to. I'll try and include those in next week's show. A couple of really important things about Representative Ilhan Omar, and a couple of things happening in Israel and Palestine. And while those are really important, the show's getting a little long. One thing I absolutely wanted to close with, Chelsea Manning has been re-arrested and sent to prison. there's a piece that was published on The Intercept on, let me get the date for this. There was a piece that was published on The Intercept on March 2nd. This is Natasha Lenard writing for The Intercept. I'd like to read just a couple of bits from the opening paragraph there, and then I'd urge you, please. I'm going to include Manning's address at the federal prison where she's currently being held. If you can, please send her a note. It really, really helps prisoners, particularly prisoners of conscience, to know that they're being supported by those of us on the outside. Quoting from The Intercept, Chelsea Manning was subpoenaed to appear before a federal grand jury and give testimony March 5th. The whistleblower filed a motion to quash the subpoena. As such, Manning risks incarceration under the coercive operations of the federal grand jury system. And this was published before she was reincarcerated. For Manning, the threat of further imprisonment is a particularly brutal one. Beginning in 2010, she was arrested, court-martialed, imprisoned, and tortured for exposing some of the worst crimes and brutalities of the Iraq and Afghan wars. She was released in 2017. Given the secrecy of federal grand jury procedures, we can't know with any certainty to which potential case the subpoena pertains or what Manning would be asked. But since it was issued in the Eastern District of Virginia, we can make informed speculation that it relates to inadvertently disclosed charges filed under seal against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in the same district. Federal grand juries are some of the blackest boxes in the judicial system, closed to the press, the public, and even attorneys. For those who have been subpoenaed, the process is rife for nefarious state use. For decades, federal grand juries have been used to investigate and intimidate activist communities, from late 19th century labor movements to the Puerto Rican independence movement and black liberationists of the last century to environmentalists, anarchists, and indigenous rights fighters more recently. There's a grim irony, particularly in Manning's case, that the purported purpose of the federal grand jury is to act as a safeguard from improper motivations of government. We need not support Assange personally to understand that his prosecution for publishing Manning's leaks would expose news organs who also publish the documents, like The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, to the same liability. The precedent that could be set for state repression of journalism is beyond troubling. Manning's challenge to the grand jury subpoena thus suggests that, as shown during her court-martial, the whistleblower understands the monumental First Amendment issues at stake in the prosecution of those who would expose government wrongdoing. Quote, Chelsea gave voluminous testimony during her court-martial. She has stood by the truth of her prior statements, and there is no legitimate purpose to having her rehash them before a hostile grand jury, said Manning's support committee, Chelsea Resists, in a statement. By employing these tactics against her, the government is using a roundabout method to punish Chelsea for her past actions, adding to the 7 years of trauma, imprisonment, and torture she has already endured. This is, make no mistake, the Empire, Republicans and Democrats, acting to repress whistleblowers and to make sure that anybody who dares expose the secrets of the Empire knows their place. I'm going to include Chelsea's address where you can write her letters at the federal prison where she's currently being held. I urge you to support her in any way that you can. Okay, things are getting a little long, so I think that's going to do it for the show this week. As usual, you can find me on socials. I'm at WChanley on Twitter, or you can catch me on the web. That's WChanley.net. And comments, as always, are open on AudioMac. And if you can, please subscribe to the show and give me a holler. See you next week.